welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts every first Sunday of the month. I'm Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Our show focuses on relationships, either romantic relationships or ones with your friends, your family, colleagues, and even your relationship with yourself.
Yeah, relationships are so important. And to have relationships, you got to have some kind of connection to somebody. And we thought we'd connect with a very well-known woman in the Bay Area tonight, one who's part of our LGBT community, one who owns her own business, and she's a comedian as well. Tonight, our guest is Mary Hughes from Mary's Futons. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's so great to have you here. We're very, very interested in hearing your story.
Most people are.
So, Living Proof concentrates on the soul of a person, who they are, what obstacles they've overcome to get to where they are today. We look forward to learning about Mary and her story. But before we speak with Mary, here's news from Outbeat member Greg Moralia.
Good evening. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for Sunday, March 6, 2011. This week, Bill O'Reilly from Fox News spoke out about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision supporting the Westboro Baptist Church. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Today, the Supreme Court ruled 8-1, 8-1, in favor of the vicious Westboro Baptist Church protesters who roam around the country screaming hatred at military funerals and other places.
God hates blacks! God hates black enablers! Therefore, God hates America!
Enter Albert Snyder, whose son Matthew, a lance corporal in the Marines, was killed in Iraq. Mr. Snyder sued the Westboro Church for intentional infliction of emotional distress and initially won $11 million from a jury. But judges overturned the verdict, even making Mr. Snyder pay court costs. And today, the Snyder family received the ultimate insult. The vicious Westboro crew won in the Supreme Court. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts said, quote, "As a nation, we have chosen to protect even hurtful speech on public issues to ensure that we do not stifle public debate," unquote. The lone dissenter was Justice Samuel Alito, who said, quote, "Our profound national commitment to free and open debate is not a license for the vicious verbal assault that occurred in this case."
And on a lighter note, here locally, Sonoma County as an LGBT tourist destination will be explored on cable and satellite dish channels all over the United States, Canada, and certain Western European countries. Bump, a syndicated program that focuses on one large city or region of interest to LGBT travelers, filmed local business owners for a 30-minute Sonoma County program that will air on Wednesday, March 23rd at 7 p.m. on the Logo channel. Logo is available locally on Comcast, DirecTV, and on Dish TV. The Sonoma County Tourism Bureau, which has for years promoted Sonoma County and specifically the Russian River as an LGBT destination, were approached by Bump last year. The Bureau set up a four-day whirlwind tour of LGBT-owned and LGBT-friendly resorts, eateries, shops, and activity groups. Craig Charles and Tina Lester of the Sonoma County Tourism Bureau worked with Bump to make sure they were aware of the best Sonoma County has to offer. Craig said, "While we have no way of tracking the direct economic impact of the show to Sonoma County, we do know that the show has a viewership of 50 million people who love to travel. Research says that gay men and lesbians are looking for gay-friendly, not necessarily an all-LGBT environment. Sonoma County is very friendly and welcoming, and this is why I built the itinerary I did. The Russian River area is still a popular gay and lesbian resort area, but I included more of Sonoma County to showcase that it's a great vacation spot for everyone." The Bump episode will feature more than 15 businesses, including El Coqui Restaurant in Santa Rosa, Osmosis Spa in Freestone, Sonoma Nesting Company in Guerneville, whale-watching tours with Captain Rick in Bodega Bay, and the Village Inn in Monterio. Craig has organized the Sonoma County Bump TV premiere party that will happen at the Rainbow Cattle Company on Main Street in Guerneville on Wednesday, March 23rd from 6 to 9 p.m. The Rainbow appears in the show as a featured watering hole. Bump is produced by a gay-owned Canadian company that has for 6 years traveled all over the world to showcase cities in the area that offer LGBT travelers interesting experiences. Their current season focuses on the United States and will include Provincetown, Saugatuck, Palm Springs, and West Hollywood. Now here's your community calendar for the coming week. On Tuesday, March 8th from 2 to 4 p.m. face-to-face, Sonoma County AIDS Network offers rapid response HIV testing at their offices at 873 2nd Street in Santa Rosa. And on Tuesday, March 8th at 6:30 p.m., TGNB, a support group for transgender individuals, gathers at Positive Images, 312 Chin Street in Santa Rosa. On March 9th from 1 to 3 p.m., Hospice by the Bay hosts a free seminar called Estate Planning for Singles and Domestic Partners at Village House on 1st Street in Sonoma. Reservations are required, so give them a call at area code 415-526-5580. On Saturday, March 12th from noon to 4 p.m., the Sonoma County Pride Committee will host Polar Plunge at the Rio Dito Roadhouse. Proceeds benefit Sonoma County Pride. And on Saturday, March 12th, out in the Vineyard, we'll host the Big Gay Train on the Napa Valley Wine Train at 5:30 p.m. More information at outinthevineyard.com. And if you have an event you'd like to share with our listeners, you can tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatradio.com. Just click on Outbeat News. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Grayer.
And hello, we're back with Mary from Mary's Futons, if you just joined us. So hello again, Mary.
Hello, hello.
So why don't you begin by just telling us a little bit about yourself and who you are and what you do.
Well, I sell futons. I started my business 28 years ago working in my garage. And my day basically is taking care of customers, doing deliveries. I like to do all my own deliveries. I'm kind of a hands-on person. I could send a couple guys out to do the job, but it would take twice as long and the van would smell funny. So I like to go out and talk to customers and just get a hands-on feel of how their sale went, whether they liked their salesperson, whether they got what they needed. It's my way of being a complete control freak.
Wow, it's very interesting. I'm curious about that van smell.
It's a man smell in the van.
Oh, this is going to be interesting.
We can feel it coming on. But let's go back to the beginning of Mary's Futon.
28 years ago.
Yeah, it all started in a small radio station in Fresno, California. No, I'm just kidding. That's Ted Knight's line from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I actually started making futons. My therapist had a client who was crazier than I was, and she had an art studio in a loft of a shipyard in Sausalito, and she made futons there. And she wanted to grow her business a little bit, so she wanted to hire somebody to do the hard work, which was making the futon. And this was in the loft of a shipyard. So you had to get the customer up a ladder that was very steep because it's a boatyard. So all your ladders are like boat ladders, which are very steep. You got to get the customer up, and you got to get the futon down. You got to get the bale of cotton up to make it was a lot of ladder work. I can walk down a ladder front facing now. It's a skill. It's an art. But at any rate, so I started making futons by hand, each one. And I didn't stay with that woman too long. As I said, she was crazier than I was. And I guess I'm a little nutty myself. I probably still am a good deal. But I started my own business making futons. And that's basically where it started. I worked in my garage. I made futons. I put an ad in the Pacific Sun. And somebody would call me for a futon, and I'd sell them one basically out of my house. And that went on for about 3 or 4 years. And then I decided that I did not have enough room in my house to have people coming down and put the futons, and I wanted to have frames. So it started to evolve into something a little bit more. So I got a little location that I got shut down right away because it wasn't zoned for retail. It was actually on a church property. So from there, I went to my little location on Redwood Highway, which I stayed at until the year 2001, I think. And I basically grew my business there. I didn't know anything about retail. I'd probably only shopped for one couch in my life. I bought one in Novato because it was brown, and I put it on my truck because I didn't know they delivered stuff like that. I mean, I really had no idea. So I learned everything as I went along, how to take care of customers, what you do. I mean, I had no clue. And you find out things that you need for your business as you get cited for them, like you need a reseller's permit number and you have to have a business license and they want you to take a diabetes test. I mean, whatever it happens to be, you know. So people say, isn't it hard to start a business? Well, it can be, but if you don't think about the small stuff and just wait till it hits you, it pretty much comes along just fine.
Well, so, you're living proof of that. I mean, 28 years in
yeah.
the making.
Yeah.
That you've been in business.
Yeah, I try to make every mistake twice, and that way I'll make sure that I have learned it. Three times, so, you know, if you need one more time, just go ahead, screw it up again and see what happens.
But on a serious note, though, I mean, not that you're not serious,
oh,
but
yeah.
people are afraid to, you know, jump out and start businesses, and you did that just by learning by working in your garage. I mean, what do you have to say to people about that?
Well, different people have different fears, and everybody, like my big fear was going into this business with a partner. Because I had seen other relationships, and I had seen them lose all their stuff. And my stuff was important to me. And I didn't want to share my fame or my money, you know, with somebody that I wasn't sure. I'd just seen too many failures to feel like I could do it with somebody. So I felt like I'm better. I didn't want to have to check with anybody to make a decision. I didn't want to have to, you know, I didn't want anybody second guessing my craziness. I just wanted to be able to do whatever I wanted to do. And for that reason, I always kept my business as mine. And I had different relationships come and go, but it was still my store, you know, and there was a balance there because it's mine. It may be wrong, but we're doing it my way. I like that.
My way.
I love that song. It makes for great success when you're successful. But when people are afraid, fear is, it's just fear of the unknown. I mean, I have a lot of fears. Everybody does. But one of my fears wasn't a failure. Because I have the kind of mind, and it's a crazy kind of mind. But if you keep seeing something in your head a certain way, you make it happen. And there's actually a school of thought that works that way. Believing is receiving. If you really focus on, you know, each detail of the plan and how you're going to do it. Well, I'm going to take this futon and I'm going to do this with it. And I'm going to buy three over here and then I'm going to sell them. And as soon as I sell those three, I'm going to go buy four more. I mean, I literally bought bales of cotton, stuffed my van full of them and then drive home and, you know, I'd cut the cloth and I'd sew it up and then I'd tuft all the futons with a 12-inch needle and I'd flip them and turn them. And it was a physical job and I loved it because at the end of the day you could see what was done and it was mine. It was my work. So that makes you feel good. Once you have a couple of successes built, then you start feeling a little more comfortable. I mean, I've taken a lot of jumps that I've landed flat. I mean, I've lost a lot of times. I could be a rich person now if I thought through everything all the way to the end. But that's what they call it. What do they call it? Oh, yeah, a business plan. I've heard this term referred to time and time again. And they have pages and pages of this business plan. All I could think of is, wow, somebody was smart enough to write all that, but not smart enough to do it. Not able to get past what it would take to take that $150 and buy four bales of cotton and turn it into two futons and sell it and buy five more. It's that simple. Everything is really simple if you break it down into smaller steps. And when you don't know what you're doing, it's easy to take small steps.
Wow. There you go. Huh? There you go out there, people.
Just
start those businesses.
Just go out and do it.
Yeah.
And you have to, You know, if you work for somebody, you know what it feels like to work for somebody. And you can see the decisions that they make and how you would do it differently. Then you get the chance to do it for yourself. You'll never work for anybody again. If you find something that you like to do and that you want to do and you enjoy doing, then it's not work. It's a craft. It's a life. It's a style. It's just, you know, you start to feel it. And that's why I went to the name Futon Mary, because I wanted people, I didn't want to introduce myself with my last name, because they'd go, oh, is that your brother? That, and I go, oh, no. So I liked being Futon Mary because, and I think the first time I did it was when I called somebody and they were at a real estate office, and I said, oh yeah, just tell them Futon Mary's calling. And they didn't even put me on hold. I could hear the person at the front desk yelling through the whole office, hey, Mac, Futon Mary's on line one. I mean, everybody heard it. So I realized instantly that marketing is an everyday little thing that you do that just puts your name out there. And people remember you. You guys both remember me, and I, you know, maybe just don't remember. I just don't.
Well, we're not going to talk about that on air, Mary, okay? Because you don't remember us. Miss Famous
there were,
Woman.
There were so many couples that evening. I don't know.
So, okay, great. Sherry, you wanted anything on...
Yeah, well,
so we can move on to...
Well, no, I wanted to go back to fear a little bit, because you mentioned that there are other things that you have fear about, but failure isn't one of them. I was wondering if you could share with us maybe one of the things that you do fear.
Ah, fear. You know, I have a serious fear of dying. We all do. But I think that... because I'm going to be 55 in a month, I'm getting to that age where we're starting to think about the fact that this is a finite experience, and it is an experience. It makes you think differently about everything. But fear, my biggest fear is I don't like to go away from home. Up until about 150 years ago, most people on this planet never moved further than 50 miles from the place they were born their whole lives. And there, I feel like kinetically inside of me, in my genes, is this need to be in this area here in Northern California where I feel comfortable. This is my turf. I don't really have any desire to travel. And so for me, fear is being out of control of my environment and not being able to maintain what I would like to do. And what I like to do is be able to help other people when they're in fear. So it's that I'm the oldest child of seven. So a lot of it has to do with taking care of your siblings and being, you know, just being the one to help, not being the problem, but being the solution. And that's really my goal, is to be at a place where I can feel comfortable all the time. And so my biggest fear is being away from home and not being able to get back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of seven, huh?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that's one of the reasons why it seems like you have to have everything go your way and everything has to... I wouldn't say...
Ouch!
No!
Please don't tell that to my sister.
No, but I'm wondering if, you know, being raised with six siblings, right? And you were the oldest, you probably had to do a lot of the taking care of. So tell us a little bit about that in your childhood, and how was that for you?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. My my parents were two people, they confuse me. They really do. They're both miserable, but they're very happy in their misery. And you know, when you're in a big family like that, and the people, your parents are kind of poor, and maybe they drink a little, but they just when you don't have that loving connection from the parents, whoever they are, then there's no trickle down.
Right.
So that means it's all pecking order all the way down the line. And, you know, as much as I tried to take care of my family and take care of my brothers and sisters, I felt I was responsible. Mm. And I was the responsible one. I'll tell you, my mom sent me out with the kids. There were six of us at the time, and I was oldest of six. Julie hadn't been born. Kevin was in a stroller. My four brothers and my sister and I were crossing Funston Street in San Francisco on a corner without a light.
How old were you?
I think I was 10. Mm-hmm. And so I got five kids, and I'm trying to cross a street, and my brothers ran out into the street. And I saw Michael, and I saw Bill, but I didn't see Brian. And there was a bus, and there was screeching brakes, and there was just all this. And for me, when my mom sent us out that day, she gave me a dollar. It's like my mom gave me a buck. And so I bought bananas because I love bananas, and we were all going to Golden Gate Park for a picnic. And so we were going to have bananas and our sandwiches. But it was a long time before I ever ate a banana again, because I thought my brother had been hit by that bus. And he hadn't been, but all the passengers were coming off, and I was mortified. Mm-hmm. But all of us kids that day, we made a pact. We never told our parents. We never told. Because we knew that there would be hell to pay, and we wouldn't get to do that again. And we really liked going and doing this little picnic thing. So my biggest fear was that something would happen while I was in charge and I would be responsible for it. But as I look back now, and as my therapist pointed out at the time, she said, Mary, Jonathan is 10 years old. That was her son. She said, do you think I'd send him in charge of five kids, one in a stroller, across a busy street in San Francisco? And I was like, So sometimes you learn through all that stuff always. You always learn. And if you're smart, you learn it real good. But that was a scary time.
That sounds traumatic.
Yeah.
Just traumatic.
Yeah. But nobody got hurt. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like bananas for a long time.
Nobody got hurt, maybe physically, but there was some wounding there in your soul.
So I learned at a young age to take charge, to be in charge, to take care of everything. Yeah. It's made me the happily uptight person that I am today.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm just kind of holding your story there, because that can be very traumatic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how are you in your relationship with your siblings and your parents now?
Well, I do speak to my mother now. Since she moved back to the state, it's kind of unavoidable. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, she's a nice enough person, but she's just, you know, I just never found any substance, you know, that was really, you know, like, what are you doing with your life? What do you want to do? Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. My mom's kind of little. And my dad...
She's kind of what?
A little crazy. Mm-hmm. Not crazy. She's just a little... She's needy. She was raised in an environment where daddy took care of everything. And daddy don't take care of everything if you marry a poor man, just so you know. Mm-hmm. So my dad, on the other hand, is still lives very close to me. I live a couple blocks from him, and he's remarried to an equally negative person. He won't be listening to this. His idea of listening to the radio, watching it on TV, he wouldn't. That's not him. But my dad is a very gruff person, but he never treated me like I was a girl. In other words, although I was his daughter and always respected as such, he bought me a toolbox for my 18th birthday. And at first I was a little angry about it, but that toolbox, to me, was his way of saying, you know, I like who you are, and you can be whoever you are. And I love my tools. I had to take my tape measure off because I didn't want you to think I was too butch. But I usually just wear it, you know, all day, every day. If I'm going to church, I still wear my tape measure. Wow. I was thinking about that the other day. What do people think when they see me and I'm wearing a tape measure? Butch. Butch.
But I'm
complete butch.
But why were you angry with your dad for?
Oh no,
I you?
because at the time when I was 18, I still wanted to be a girl. I wanted to be, you know, that was back in the time when you first come out. I came out when I was 17 and a half, 18. When you first come out, although you're excited about coming out and discovering this whole new thing, there's still that fear that you won't be accepted on that other level. So I was hurt, but I wasn't, you know, my dad and I always had a terse thing, you know, because I have a great sense of justice, and my father does not like to decide or say, you're wrong, you're right. He doesn't like to do that. He's a peacemaker, and he's an Aquarian. So I always was coming to my dad and saying, Dad, you know, Mike did this, or Peg did this, or Bill this. And he'd look at me and he'd say, Mary Alice, I'll be the daddy, and you be the little girl. And that would just make me nuts. Mm. So, no, I love my dad. My dad, my girlfriend Paula and I have been taking my dad out while my stepmother was recovering in a home there. She's home now today. But we would take my dad out for dinner, and it just tickled him pink that, you know, he's got two good-looking women out, and he's being the center of attention, you know, like most old men. He's a nice guy. My sister, I have a sister who's an attorney. She went back to law school at the age of 50 or 48 after being dumped by her girlfriend. She's gay as well, and she's now an attorney practicing in L.A. And I have a brother who's a fence man, a brother who's in construction, a brother who's crazy. I told my dad that you guys were going to interview me. He said, what do you think would happen if they interviewed Bill? He's like Tourette's, okay? And then my brother Kevin, he's a bodybuilder and also a construction guy. Mm. And then I have a younger sister who's a hooker. Mm. Yeah. There you have it. Mm. There you have it right there. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to tell you that Mary is not really here. This is just someone impersonating her voice.
We're going to take a music break. And as you were talking, I just, you know, we had one song that we were going to play, but I want to play this other song that reminds me of you, because the song is called Back to Me, and I feel like you gave yourself. This is Ari Gold.
No one must have heard. When did you learn?
Proof with Mary's Futons. Mary from Mary's Futons. As
Futon
our guest.
Mary.
Futon Mary. We are in studio with Futon Mary.
Hey, they don't call me that because I sleep around. It was just a coincidence.
You were just listening. If you just joined us, you were listening to Ari Gold singing Back to Me. And we played that in Mary's honor because she told us of a very powerful story of when she was young and taking care of her five siblings crossing a busy street. It was very powerful. And I felt like even though we play the song a lot by Ari Gold, it was really appropriate for tonight.
Mm-hmm. It's an important song, period. So, Mary, let's jump in and let's talk about coming out. I know you mentioned it about 18 years. You were 18 years old. And who did you come out? How did you know? You know.
Well, I had a friend at Santa Fe High. She went to continuation. I was in my senior year. She was the older sister of somebody that I hung out with. Carol Kitchell was her name, if she's listening tonight. She asked me, here's the way she approached it. She said, "Do you masturbate?" And I said, I mean, I was all of 17 and a half. And, you know, it's not like this was a frequent topic of discussion in high school with my friends. So I looked at her and I said casually, with the air of the salesperson I was about to become, "Well, doesn't everybody?" Because always answer a question with a question when you have no idea what to say. And that started out, because really, I was a tomboy, but I never thought of myself as a lesbian. I just thought of myself as a person who should have been able to wear pants at school, but wasn't allowed to because I didn't have a penis to put in them. I only had, you know, so I always froze. We grew up in the city. Oh, my God, it was cold in that skirt. So Santa Fe High, circa 1974, Carol Kitchell asked me this question. And shortly after that, we were partying somewhere, and we were going up to somebody's house, I think, and she kissed me. She kissed me in the car. And, I mean, I had dated a lot of guys, and I'd gone steady with Bill Morris, and I thought for sure I was going to be marrying Bill Morris and blah, 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 blah. And all those bells and whistles that people would talk about, the kiss, aha, it wasn't like that with a guy. And then I thought, well, maybe it's because it's forbidden, you know, but nah, it felt too good for that. So Carol and I were together for about a year, and we had a great relationship. I'm going to tell you this quick story. We were up at her apartment one time. I was cutting class, and she lived next door to this other woman, and we all three would hang out together. But Carol and I were having a little afternoon delight in her apartment, and we were playing the Maria Muldaur song, Midnight at the Oasis. And it was on a 45. For those of you who are youths in our audience, a 45 is a very small record that's played on a turntable. It has a big hole in the middle, and it's only got one song on each side, and it plays at a different speed than everything else. Okay, that's why they call it a 45. It's not a gun or anything. So we were playing this 45, Midnight at the Oasis, and, well, we had afternoon delight most of the afternoon. After about an hour or so, in about the 50th playing of Midnight at the Oasis. Midnight at the Oasis, woo! We heard this banging at the door, and it was a next-door neighbor banging, saying, "I don't care how loud you guys are while you're making love, but if you play that song one more time, I'm calling the police." So years later, I actually had Maria Muldaur in my store, and I said, "Oh, Maria." She's there with her assistant. "Oh, Maria, I got to tell you my Midnight at the Oasis story." And she looked at me and said, "Everyone has a Midnight at the Oasis story," which is her way of saying, "I don't want to hear it." But aww. I didn't pick up on that, and I launched into my story, and she thought it was funny. She actually laughed. So anyway, back to coming out. That was my first experience with a woman. And my friends from high school, because I hadn't graduated yet, were very curious, in a not completely friendly way, about what I was doing. And, well, what do you guys do? What does a girl do with another girl? Pretty much the same thing as you do with a guy, except, you know, it's not as messy. Well, they thought that was funny. But I didn't get beat up or anything, but I was kind of ostracized from the group that I had hung around with. But the nice thing about graduating high school and coming out at the same time is you get a whole new set of friends. And I just started hanging around with a bunch of women and finding out what being gay was all about. And I didn't really have a lot of relationships because I fell in love with somebody that I pined away for about 7 years. And then I started moving on and doing relationships. And
How old were you then when you were pining after this one woman?
Well, that was 18. I pined away for her until I was about 26. Yeah. Maybe 25
or
26.
Can you describe what you mean by pining away?
Pining away is wanting somebody you can never have, who's not attracted to you, but you still feel a very strong connection to. And you think about them every night when you're alone in your bed. That's pining.
And at the same time, you probably had like 20 women pining at you. Right?
Well, you know, not at that time. When I was young, I was wild. I was out there. I was crazy. I was not relationship material when I was young. But now it's like, it's great because everybody, you know, you kind of get that look from, and I like it. But a lot of that is because I've matured and I have the respect of being in business a long time. It's not just for my hot body. It's, you know, it's more about the mind now.
So we get more into that deeper relationship stuff. But it sounds, listening to you, Mary, I mean, you present as a really proud woman, you know, like that Proud Mary song.
Yeah.
Proud Mary. And so I wanted to go somewhere with that with you as far as relying on your family for support and your friends for support, as you know, during the process of coming out. It seemed like that wasn't necessary for
No.
you. It seemed like you were...
No, it seemed... You know, I was raised Catholic, and that would seem like a good reason to not understand being gay. But for me, I made it real simple once again. God says you should love one another. That's it. One another. He didn't say girls love guys and guys... I mean, it was love one another. And if God says that love is the ultimate place to be, and I'm in love, it didn't matter to me that it was somebody else. And like I said, because that happened at that point where I was graduating and leaving that little, and I really didn't have a big structure of support. You know, I really didn't have that as a kid. It wasn't family for me. It wasn't my, you know, I hung around with a couple friends, but it wasn't that kind of support system. I didn't find a support system that truly felt great until I was 27. And I found my therapist, Eileen Dillon, fabulous woman. She's been in Marin County for forever. And she reparented me, because that's what therapy is. It's basically reparenting and changing your ideas and giving you some other examples of what functionality looks like. So I stayed with her for a long time. We're still friends. But she took me to a performance of a group called the Mayflower Chorus. And that was the spark. The Mayflower Chorus changed my life. Changed my life. Now, it's not a gay organization. This, actually, the Mayflower Chorus is a group of drinkers with a singing problem.
Oh, my word. Say more.
So the Mayflower Chorus, here's how it happened. I'm at this show, and it was in July, and I remember because it was a birthday celebration for the director. It was the Playhouse that you and I had discussed earlier. And this group stood in this tight square formation, and they sang the Star Spangled Banner, and I had chills. And it's not that I'm so patriotic, but I am. It was the music. I loved the music. And then they did the battle hymn. Now, the battle hymn of the Republic was, what's her name? Anita Bryant's theme song. But that didn't mean anything to me. The battle hymn, the harmony lines in that middle part where the tenors come in and sing that high note, and the second tenors and the baritones and the basses, it is so fabulous. And then you've got all four women's parts. I was hooked. I was hooked right then. At the end of the show, all the singers were back down on the stage around the piano singing again. It's like they couldn't get enough. And then somebody went, all right, everybody, let's go. And I got swept up in this group of people, and we all got into our cars, and we drove up into the hills of Ross, and we all parked somewhere, and we somebody's house, and we went in there, and it was called a cast party. And at this cast party at the Mayflower Chorus, they had what I learned was an open cooler concept. And that was when you took your cooler in, you could get anything out of anybody's cooler. I'd never seen such a thing in my life. You know, so there I was at this party, and these people were singing some more. There was a bunch of people over there with Lisa singing on the guitar, and Conrad was playing the piano, and they were singing over there, and I was just in heaven. I loved it. I joined that group not too long after. As a matter of fact, the friend that I was so enamored with, I said, let's go check out this group. And she didn't want to go. She was fearful. She did not go, but I drank 3 beers, smoked a little pot, and I went into this rehearsal. And the woman who had asked me if I liked to sing there at the party, she said, do you like to sing? I go, oh, you know, she said, well, come to our rehearsal. So I go to this rehearsal, and I meet this very tall, imposing guy with this big handlebar mustache. And Carol says, Larry, this is Mary. She thinks she's a tenor. And that's how I joined the chorus. Because they said, do you sing a part? And I said, well, what part do you need? Well, we need tenors. I go, well, I'll sing tenor. I had no idea it had anything to do with your vocal range. But I'm a great tenor. And that started my time with the Mayflower Chorus, 15 years. A lot of those people I still hang around with, they're my family, they're my friends, they're my aunts, my uncles, my surrogate mothers, all of them. And surrogate fathers. I mean, these people, the music brought us together. And we sang 2 shows a year, of 30 different shows. And there were weddings, there were births, there were funerals that we've gone to. We've buried a lot of members over time. I've seen kids grow up in the chorus, become actors in their own right, and singers and directors and choreographers. And one of them's now in New York. I mean, just that support that you get from being in a group of like-minded people, it changed my life. It changed my life.
Are you still singing with them?
No, I'm not. You know, our director died in 1992, Larry Vargo. And the leader of anything makes what it is, really determines the way it goes. And we had another director come in that was part of our group. But, you know, it wasn't the same, and he tried really hard, but he got frustrated because nobody was, you know, we were all in mourning, and Larry founded that, you know. And how this group started was, one Christmas, they're all drinking down there at the Mayflower Inn, and Larry says, let's go caroling. So they walked up and down the streets of 4th Street, stopping at every bar, and they'd sing a few songs, and the house would buy them around, and they'd go to the next one. And that was the beginning of the Mayflower Chorus. And it grew into this huge, it's now a nonprofit group. They still go today. They have scholarships that they award every year to different members and to people that apply. They've been to Poland. They've just been all over. I can't think of all the places they've been because I don't go because I don't like to travel. But I stopped singing with them a number of years back when Larry passed, and I started singing with the singers Marin. It wasn't the same, you know. And I still sing with them sometimes, and there's still a lot of music, a lot of singing goes on. Whenever we can get together, you know, we do it. It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. You came alive. I saw that.
Yeah, it's the music.
Yeah.
I miss it.
Yeah.
I miss it, but I'm so busy. I can't really do a rehearsal after loading futons and frames and doing deliveries all day. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's not enough of me left to get on stage for 4 days twice a year after all those rehearsals. You know,
and also being in this new loving relationship that we would like to ask you about.
Ah, yes. I'll tell the story her way. She's going to love this. I started doing these comedy shows. I had somebody that I lived with. about 6 or 7 years back. My first love relationship for a long time. Like, oh yeah, the last one was my cousin, but that's another story. Anyway, so my ex left, moved out, took everything. I walked around and cried for just like 100 days. I cried every day. I was so sad. And had to do something to get out of it. So I figured, well, let's do a comedy show at my store. So I got a hold of this comedian, fabulous woman named Lisa Gaduldig. And I chased her down literally in a restroom and said, I want to do a comedy show in my futon store. She thought I was nuts. But we started doing them, and she's incredible, incredible marketer. She knows how to market on a shoestring. You want to know how to make money with nothing? Lisa Gaduldig. She's great. So I throw these comedy shows, and I have them in my store. And one of my displays, I turn it around, and it's a stage. And I've got lighting, and I've got a sound system, and we've done some political fundraisers there. We do fundraisers for nonprofit groups. I've had something for the Mountain Play, which is a great thing. We're going to do Hairspray this year, so we're going to have a fundraiser on April 17th. It's going to be a karaoke night in my store. We just turn all the futons towards the stage. We set up a little bar in the back. We do a little food, and, I mean, we have a good time. So it's my first comedy show, well, one of my first, and evidently this woman, Paula, had heard about the show. She lived nearby. She was just coming out a little bit more, so she comes to the show. And after the show, she sees this book, 100 Faces of Marin, and she wants to buy it. But nobody knows how to sell it to her. My people that were there as assistants, we don't know anything about the books. We could sell you a beer or a glass of wine. But so she says, well, fine, Mary. So here I come bounding down the stairs. This is the way Paula tells it. Bounding down the stairs, coming up to her. Yes, what do you want? And so Paula said, well, thank you very much for inviting me this evening. And I said, well, I didn't invite you. I'm so tacky. She tells this story a lot better than me. I said, well, I didn't really invite you. You probably got an email, but okay. So, you know, that's my way of just being myself. I'm just kind of, you know, that way. Some people call that being a jerk. I call it sarcasm and humor. So, well, she says, well, I thank you for the nice evening. I would just like to buy this book because I need to go home. I go, well, give me $30 and get out of here. And so she gave me $30, and she turned to walk away, and I said, hey, wait a minute, where are you going? She's thinking to herself, she told me, what does this woman want now? And she turned around, and I said, don't you want me to autograph it? And she said, oh, you're in this book? So that's how I met Paula. So I thought she was straight. I mean, I did. Look at this good-looking woman. I thought she was either straight or in a guy in drag because, you know, lesbians usually don't dress that nicely. And she's, you know, kind of muscular and athletic and kind of walked up and knew what she was. I just couldn't tell. It was dark. She had on lipstick. It could have been a guy. So anyway, Paula called the next day and left a message. She wanted to pick my brain. Did I want to go to coffee? And she wanted to talk about advertising. And I thought, oh, God, another straight woman wants to meet me. Please spare me. Because you know how they lead you on. So, you have no idea. Oh, well, you should go out more often. Anyway.
No, she shouldn't.
Okay. There's that third wall just dropped. Okay. So, she called back a couple days later and asked me if I'd like to go to coffee. And I said, well, I don't really do coffee. And I said, how about lunch? And, you know, she's looking at the phone going, well, I don't really do lunch. And so by then it was like, she said, how about a glass of wine? At dinner time, at six, I go, well, you're going to cut into my dinner hour there. So I was doing everything I could to discourage her. I mean, if you're going to like me after that, you're really going to like me. So we went out to dinner. We went to this little, I wanted to go to Chili's. But she called back because, you know, they got appetizers and a beer. She wanted to go to this citrus and spice Thai food. And I thought, oh, Thai food. Well, I could probably eat something there. I'm sure they have a spring roll. So I got there, and sure enough, no beer, no sake, nothing. So Paula orders a glass of wine. I said, make it a bottle. And then I looked at the menu, and there's the spring roll, and I ordered it, and it came, and I looked at it. It was this little gelatinous thing all rolled up around stuff I couldn't even identify. And right in the middle, there was this shrimp with a piece of mint. Now, I'm a firm believer in mint, but mint belongs three places: in my toothpaste, on my pillow, and in candy canes. Mint does not belong with shrimp in anyway. I don't eat as a regular. I'm pedestrian palate. Not too much Thai food. Anyway, that's how I met Paula. And as I was telling you earlier, I told her when I first met her that, because she was not closeted, but she's in a professional, she's an accountant, so she likes to be professional, present herself professionally, and that's not necessarily lesbian. So I told her when I met her, I said, you know, we can go out, we can date, I'd love to date, but if you go out with me, people are going to know that you're gay. And she said, why? How are they going to know that? And I said, well, if you go out with me, people will know that you are gay. Anyway, she had a hard time wrapping her head around that, but sure enough, she goes out with me. Well, you know, for you listening audience out there who cannot see me, if you could, you would obviously see that I'm so butch. And all I'm missing really is that extra upper lip hair, which I very carefully pluck. I didn't want to be boring tonight, so I brought
nothing
my extra
chin.
Comedy. No, no, nothing. No, not at all. I lie very well, don't I? So anyway, Paula is fabulous. I have never been in a relationship where I've been so respected and loved and treated lovingly. And it's amazing what kind of person you become when somebody treasures who you are. Mm-hmm. It's like all the good stuff about you just comes out. And the bad stuff, well, except for the controlling and the obsession, all the bad stuff goes away. Mm-hmm. So if you want to be loved, be loving and get loved, and mm-hmm. then you'll love yourself. But, you know, before I met Paula, I was happy being single. I liked being alone. And when you're happy by yourself, then you can be happy with somebody else. And that's, to me, the real key is be the person. You become the person that you want to find. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. when you find that, mm-hmm. when you find that, you find love. Mm-hmm. It finds you. Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to go really searching. Were you searching before, Paula?
I searched a little, mm-hmm. but not very hard. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes... My father told me this. The fates have a grim the grim sardonic fates. Anyway, you have to be careful what you pray for, because sometimes you get it. Mm-hmm. So
we are going to have to quit our interview. We have to stop
in about two or three minutes.
Yeah, and just wondering, I mean, you've already given a little advice. I really like what you said, if you want to be loved, be loving.
Mm-hmm.
I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something else that you would care to share with the audience about in your philosophy of life, advice, or how you did it, how you do it, how you continue to want to do it? I mean, are there words to the wise out there?
I'll tell you what I would, I don't know if I have that answer, but I'll tell you what I would say. What I try to do every day, what makes me feel good, is to find some way each day to be somebody's hero. Some little thing. Maybe it's some lady who got something stuck in the cup holder of her car, and she's at Home Depot trying to get some guy to help her sell her something so she can get that little thing out. You know, and maybe it's just anything, some way that you could help somebody do something, and it's just the littlest thing, but that makes you feel good. And when you feel good, you're in the right mind to make good decisions about everything. You're not cluttered with anger, because you're getting the gratitude that somebody has for you when you help them. So to help somebody, to be somebody's hero, to always try to help people, to serve, is the greatest way to reap rewards. And that includes profit. To serve. Find a way to serve somebody, and you will be remunerated greatly in many ways.
Mm, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. My students could use that. I like that a lot because everybody's so self-absorbed and poor me, poor me.
The first thing to do is teach them to say thank you. Mm-hmm. And make a list of what you're grateful for today. You know, just, do you have your hands? Can you see? Did you hear that bell just go off? Can you taste what you're eating? Do your feet hurt today? You know, somebody doesn't have feet. So, you know, there's people that don't have what you have. And that's the key to really appreciating what you have. Mm-hmm. Make a list. I can smell the flowers. That's mm-hmm. that's a great thing. Mm-hmm. And I can hear the chimes.
Thank you so much for being our guest today. I feel like we wish we had another hour to talk with you, Mary.
Well, thank really you. That's a kind thing to say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Mary. I mean, I can feel your big heart, and you're such a proud woman, and it's nice to be in your company right now.
Thank you. I really appreciate being asked to be here. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
We hope that you and the listening audience got inspired by listening to Mary, and like her, with hard work and persistence and dedication and believing in yourself, you too can be living proof that you can achieve your dreams. We'll see you next month.
Good night.
Still so many answers I don't know.
There are so many answers.
Realize that to question is how we grow.
To question is to grow.
So I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending.
Right now, public media is the subject of a critical debate in Washington. Funding to keep public television and radio, and with it their quality news and cultural programming on the air, is in question. 170 million Americans engage with public media every month. You're one of them, and we're asking for your voice. Go to 170millionamericans.org and sign up for the campaign, Help Protect the Station You Love.